This is Masters in Business with Barry Ritholtz on Bloomberg Radio.
This week on Masters in Business, we have a very special foreign affairs edition of our podcast. You know, given everything that's been going on around the world, we have the Chinese currency devaluation. We have Russia invading Ukraine and annexing Crimea. We're normalizing relations with Cuba. We're in the midst of an enormous policy negotiation about the Iran nuclear deal. I thought it would be a good time to bring in somebody with a broad and deep expertise on foreign affairs. And I was fortunate enough to somehow talk Dr. Leslie Gelb into joining us. You know, if I read his curriculum vitae on the air, it would take up the whole 90-minute podcast. He's just an incredibly storied guy. We get into some of the broader aspects of what he's done. Started as a PhD professor at a school, gets recruited by Senator Jacob Javits, was the senator from New York State to the U.S. Senate. And from there, the Department of Defense, the State Department, to the New York Times, to the Council of Foreign Relations. He called it failing upwards, but let's be honest, the guy is just a fascinating, amazing person. General McNamara appoints him to the head of the project that essentially produces the famous Pentagon Papers, which was a broad and deep look at the U.S. involvement in Vietnam. While we're still in the midst of Vietnam, it was sort of a moment of reflection to figure out, hey, what are we doing right and wrong, and what lessons can we learn about this for future military entanglements? His concept of how to interact with other countries, the limits and positives of projecting both military and economic power. Quite fascinating. What he has to say about China is amazing. He has some insights as to how their military works and where it works and where they've purposefully avoided military entanglements is really quite fascinating. He tells stories about dinners with Fidel Castro and presenting to the generals of Cuba, just really, really amazing stuff. I found it absolutely interesting. He is not without controversy, but usually it's for good reasons, because he says things that the powers that be don't like to hear, even though they're fact-based and true and time and again have turned out to be correct. Oh, I left out, in the middle of all these jobs, he takes a position with the New York Times as a foreign policies correspondent, and ultimately wins a Pulitzer Prize for his work reporting on Ronald Reagan's Strategic Defense Initiative, an in-depth 6-part series. Ironically, here's a guy who never so much has written for a high school paper, writes for the Times, wins a Pulitzer. Just incredible. Incredibly accomplished, unbelievably knowledgeable and insightful. Given all the things that are going on in the world, all the really major macro situations that are roiling countries and currencies and economies, and of course that impacts the market, what better time is there than today for a conversation with Dr. Les Gelb? So with no further ado, here's our discussion on foreign affairs with Leslie Gelb.
This is Masters in Business with Barry Ritholtz on Bloomberg Radio.
I have a very special guest, and the timing could not be more opportune. Dr. Leslie Gelb, whose curriculum vitae will take up the entire show if I read it, but I will just give you the brief overview as to why our guest is so perfect, given everything that's happening in the world these days. Dr. Gelb got his BA and MA from Tufts University before getting his PhD from Harvard in 1964. He then taught government at Wesleyan before Jacob Javits recruited him to become his executive assistant. Javits was the senator from New York and one of my favorites. He ultimately ended up becoming the director of Bureau of Political Military Affairs. He was appointed by Secretary of Defense McNamara as director of the project that ultimately produced the Pentagon Papers. He then moved on to the New York Times, where he was a diplomatic correspondent, winning the Pulitzer Prize for explanatory journalism for a six-part series on the Star Wars Strategic Defense Initiative, president of the Council of Foreign Relations, president emeritus, and the rest of this list is too long to go into, author of numerous books on foreign policy. Let me just stop there and say, Dr. Gelb, welcome to Bloomberg.
Good to be here.
So the timing is really fortuitous. We've been talking about this some time ago, but here we are with all sorts of things happening in Iran, Cuba, China. The world has just really been just going through all sorts of changes. Let's start with your career. And from the beginning, how do you end up going from a professor at a college to essentially running the office of a U.S. senator?
It was a miracle.
Okay.
You get jobs initially based on connections, who you know where. And when I was doing my PhD at Harvard, I met a lot of people. Some of these people were involved with Republican politics in Congress. And one of these guys heard that Javits was looking for an executive assistant to focus on foreign affairs, international economics, defense, so forth, and recommended me, went to see Javits, and then all the rest of the career kind of flowed from there. Because, and this is something your business people, financial people will appreciate, there's actually justice, I think, to jobs. If you show you know how to get things done, you're in a 1% at the top, and everybody wants you because it means they don't have to worry about doing it themselves.
They give you an assignment, and it gets
finished. And it gets done. It gets done at a decent quality, and I demonstrated that. So the rest of the career just flowed almost miraculously and without any planning. I mean, when the New York Times offered me the job as a diplomatic correspondent, I told Abe Rosenthal, who was the executive editor of the Times, I said, I've never even been on a junior high school newspaper.
And that ultimately, so let's talk a little bit about the Times, although there's a lot of career in between Javits's office and the Times. In between, Secretary of Defense McNamara, was that his title at the time, SecDef?
Yes, he was Secretary of Defense.
Appoint you to a committee. The person running the committee, if memory serves correctly, dies in a plane crash. And you end up taking over project, or am I misremembering that?
It didn't happen that way. My immediate boss, the Assistant Secretary of Defense, John McNaughton, was promoted from that Assistant Secretary job to be Secretary of the Navy. A few days later, he and members of his family died in a crash.
Okay.
But I was, at the time, Director of Policy Planning in the Pentagon, another office for which I was not qualified.
Right.
I was 30 years old. And I had that job, and then within weeks of having that job, I was also given the task of doing what became the Pentagon Papers, the history of U.S. involvement in Vietnam.
And we're going to definitely talk more about Vietnam a little later. You say you weren't qualified, but you were awarded from the State Department the Distinguished Honor Award, which is their highest recognition for the work you did. So when you say
you
weren't
qualified— I was in the Defense Department first.
Okay.
I went from Javits to the Defense Department, and I also got the highest award there, too.
So that suggests that perhaps you were somewhat qualified.
Or it suggests that they give away the awards too easily.
Okay, so that's the other side of the argument. I was trying to give you the benefit of the doubt, and well, I'm going to have to go to Wikipedia and rewrite your bio. They give these awards out to— How do I get one of those? Can I just apply, or— I don't think they give them out all that often, and to have one both from the Department of Defense and from the State Department—
Right.
That's a fairly respectable— Right, that's a fairly respectable achievement. So now you essentially oversee the creation of the Pentagon Papers, which details in tremendous specificity what happened in Vietnam, what the goals were, and where it went wrong. This was supposed to be an internal study, not released to the public, correct?
That's right.
And so there, I believe there were 15 copies, some of which were leaked, parts of which were leaked to the New York Times.
That's right. Ellsberg, Daniel Ellsberg, leaked almost a full set to the Times. He didn't include the four volumes on the secret negotiations.
You're listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio. My special guest today is Dr. Leslie Gelb, an expert on foreign affairs and the projection of power and influence around the world. One of the things that you've written that I've always found fascinating is it's not necessarily just military strength, but it's the underlying economic strength that really has a giant impact on foreign policy. Let's start discussing that. What is the role of the fundamental economic power of a country to influence its foreign policy?
Economics is really now central to power in foreign policy, to power in international relations. Throughout history, it was military power, military force, that was the main arbiter of things. Big countries made demands on lesser ones. If they didn't obey, they got cracked. They got defeated on the battlefield.
Now, isn't the underlying economic strength of, go back to the Romans or the Greeks or whoever we want to look to in history, the ability to field a large, well-equipped, well-fed standing army, isn't that a function of their underlying economy?
The economy, of course, was important in sustaining a large and effective army, but it wasn't a typical instrument of foreign affairs. When things came to be settled between tribes or nations, it was by force.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at most international transactions today, there is very, very little force, historically unprecedented little force, between nations. They used to go out and fight each other all the time. It's very rare now you see one nation attack another nation. Almost all the wars are within nations, within Afghanistan, within Iraq, within Vietnam, and so forth.
That's a huge positive development, the amount of wars and battlefield skirmishes between countries. So Russia and the Ukraine, that's an aberration?
Well, Russia isn't in open conventional warfare. They sent in their special forces, and they built up units of Russian-speaking Ukrainians. And basically, that's how the war is being fought, rather than by main force Russian units.
So it was really, they sort of fomented a civil war.
Rebellion.
Yeah.
That's
interesting. Right. So back to the economy. Here we are in the early decades of the 21st century. The United States remains the largest, most significant economy in the world. But China is, despite their recent stock market issues and their slowdown in their economy, is soon to be the largest economy in the world. How does that play into their ability to project influence
right.
around the world?
See, China is a perfect case of what I'm talking about, because China is the first global power, global great power, not to be a global military power. China has no real military punch worldwide. China's military strength is restricted almost entirely to its borders and to adjacent seas.
Now, they're building up their air force. They're supposedly adding all these different carrier and submarine groups. They're taking a lot of their newfound economic wealth and directing some of it to the military. What does that mean?
They're directing more and more of it to the military, but it's almost entirely in the Asia-Pacific region. To become a world military power, you need bases worldwide, and you need the capabilities to move navies and air units around the world. They don't begin to have this.
What does that say to us about China's aspirations that this doesn't seem to be a focus of theirs, at least at present?
Well, that's the necessary qualifier, at least at present. What they're doing is what China has done throughout its history, really, to make sure that they were the strongest country on their borders. And they're shoring that up right now. But they, in the process, they are developing a capability to project their military power further than they ever did before. But they're still nowhere near it. They're a decade or two away from having that kind of capability.
Now, I've seen arguments. So,
but just to finish the point, but China counts around the world, not because it can apply military force in the Middle East or Africa or whatever. No one even thinks of China militarily in those places, but because of its trade and investments.
Is there a lesson there for the United States?
Sure.
You look at how much we spend on our military, depending on which study you look at, it's the next 12 or 15 countries combined. Are we hurting ourselves by having an overemphasis on military spending versus competitors like China?
Yeah, it's not the next 10 or 15 total equaling the American total defense now. It's about eight or so of the next most.
Still a big number.
Yeah, it is. It is a very big number. And, the Chinese military budget probably is in the neighborhood of $125-150 billion. And we're still up around $500 billion. But it's not just that. It's having experience in being able to control military technology, to make it operational. We've been in wars, so our military knows how to use this stuff. China is much less proficient at it.
So what does that mean going forward? Is China, because what I'm hearing from you is China is obviously an economic competitor, but not really very much of a military threat to the United States interests.
Yes, but China is ensuring that it controls its borders and the immediate water areas. And that does mean something because we have allies in that area.
Taiwan, Japan.
South Korea and so forth, Philippines. We have treaties with these countries. And they feel the threat coming from Chinese muscling. Chinese muscling into the islands in the South China Sea and claiming them as part of Chinese territory and the like. But you see, as much as the nations of Asia are turning more and more to the United States for security protection, they don't want to go too far. They don't want to anger China because China is still the most important factor in that part of the world when it comes to trade and investment.
You're listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio. My special guest today is Dr. Leslie Gelb, author of many books, winner of numerous awards, including the Pulitzer Prize, currently President Emeritus on the Council on Foreign Relations. Is that correct?
Close enough.
And and an expert on all sorts of issues related to foreign affairs. Let's start with a really broad question in this segment. Are we entering a new era of diplomacy for the United States?
It's a new era of foreign policy generally, because problems are becoming more and more difficult to solve, not just within our country domestically, but worldwide, because major powers don't have anywhere near the power they used to have. Now, we used to be able to combine with Europe and get a lot of things done. And now, the problems, as I explained before, are less between nations where you can apply that power, that leverage, more within nations. They have their own political problems. They have their own civil wars. And it's much more difficult for the power of the United States or China or Russia, whatever, to influence events within countries rather than between them.
So you mentioned Europe. At one point in time, I thought of Europe as a great power. You look at the history, at least of Western civilization, and first it was Spain, and then it was France, and then it was England, and Europe seemed to be the center of the world. That's not really the case anymore, is it?
No, for hundreds of years, Europe was the center of the world, and that's where power was located. And they went out and they, in effect, ruled the world, conquered all these territories, created colonies, and the like.
Including us here in the United States.
Exactly.
And now?
Now Europe is a second-tier power at best. Its military punch is far, far less than it has been historically. You know, Germany used to be one of the great powers of the world, Britain and so forth. But now they're really all second tier.
What about the EU as an economic power? It's one of the biggest economies collectively.
Right. It's one of the biggest, but it doesn't do a very good job of exercising economic power because the damn organization is so bureaucratic.
Mm-hmm.
And it thinks less in terms of using power to accomplish difficult things and more in terms of just getting along without creating problems.
Quite fascinating. Let me shift gears a little bit on you and talk about oil. I understand the whole economic thesis that strong economy equals strong projection of power. Let me ask a question this way. Is the price of oil driving policy, or is policy driving the price of oil?
Well, in the case of the Gulf states, let's say, they have so much money, they don't have to worry about $5 extra dollars per barrel or $25 extra dollars per barrel. They're loaded.
Mm-hmm.
So their primary concern is foreign policy. So why is the price of oil as low as it is? It's as low as it is because they're keeping it that way. And they're keeping it that way in anticipation of Iran joining the oil market again in a major way. Mm-hmm. And they want to make sure that Iran can't put its hand on as many bucks as the Iranian leaders may hope. So they're keeping it low. They realize that Iran is going to have more money and therefore more impact, but they want to lessen that blow.
And Iran has been a little bit of a troublemaker in the Middle East, to say the least.
Yes, Iran has been a troublemaker, but if you ask me,
mm-hmm.
Saudi Arabia has caused the United States far more trouble over the last 30, 40 years than Iran has.
So let's focus on that. That's fascinating.
Yeah, let me just explain that, because most Americans just aren't aware. Who on earth funded all these jihadis, Al-Qaeda, ISIS, Al-Nusra? Where did these funds come from? Where did the arms they've been fighting with come from? They come mainly from Saudi Arabia and the Gulf countries. They've been financing it. They've been creating the problem, our big partners there from that part of the world, for their own reasons, usually religious reasons, and their opposition to Western values. And you see this most clearly in the thousands of madrasas.
Mm-hmm.
These are Islamic schools funded by the Saudis and other Gulf states around the world.
And they preach extreme fundamental versions of Islam.
Right, and anti-Americanism and anti-American values.
So in the last minute we have in the segment, why do we think of Saudi Arabia as our ally?
Because our government lets them get away with it and doesn't make an issue of it. But, you know, it's a fact that the arms that ISIS used at first were financed by the Saudis and the other Gulf states.
You're listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio. My special guest today is Dr. Leslie Gelb, an expert on foreign policy and foreign affairs and the impact of a domestic economy and how it affects a country's ability to project power. Last segment, we talked a little bit about this new era of diplomacy. Before we go back to Iran, let's talk a little bit about Cuba, which I think was a surprise for a lot of people. No one really expected anything from a lame duck president, and yet there seems to be a lot of diplomatic initiatives that are starting to bear fruit. What are your thoughts on our change of status with Cuba?
Well, I'm glad we're doing it.
Overdue?
Yeah, way, way, way overdue. And the only thing that prevented it, really, was the power of the Cuban-American Foundation, a group run by Cuban emigres who really locked on Cuba policy in many ways like the American Jewish community locked on Middle East policy and on Israel. So they the Cuban American Foundation prevented doing any kind of opening with Cuba when it didn't make any sense. And here for 50 years,
right,
we had economic sanctions against them. We tried to tighten the noose around them in every way possible. It doesn't work. Economic sanctions can hurt a country, and sure, it's hurt Cuba a great deal, but it can't bring them to their knees. It can't make them capitulate. We face the same issue with Russia and Ukraine, and we never learned the lesson. And when the economic sanctions don't work, people start talking about, well, maybe we have to go to war.
Now, haven't the economic sanctions worked with Iran? Didn't we get them to really dramatically reduce their nuclear program or not? What's the take on that?
We got them to dramatically reduce it, which is why I think this agreement is a good one. We can come back to that later.
Okay.
We did get them to dramatically reduce it for 10 to 15 years, unless there's cheating and there's a breakout or so forth.
So let's go back to the sanction issue. You have a group in America, a number of different Cuban-American groups who don't want to see relations normalized. Is the reason for that they have a degree of power and a voting block, and once this goes away, their power goes away? At what point do they just become a self-defeating, self-sustaining for no more purpose political group?
It takes too long for that to happen.
Well, here it is half a century later. What are we to make of either of the Cuban-American group or the Jewish-American group affecting these sort of policy negotiations?
Well, you know, in 1994, 1995,
mm-hmm.
my wife and I were invited by Fidel Castro to Cuba. And we had dinner with him one night, the two of us, he and his foreign minister, whatever. And we were talking about what democracy was. And I interrupted him and I said, you know, you don't understand that democracy is minorities rule.
Mm-hmm.
The Jewish American groups are the primary influence on Middle East policy, the Greeks on Greek policy, the aged on
elderly. That's fascinating. That's a fascinating way to describe it.
The gun lobby controlling guns. You look issue to issue, who controls financial legislation? It's Wall Street. And that American democracy is minorities rule.
Well, so what is Castro's reaction to that?
He said, you see, that's what I'm talking about. You don't have a democracy. Yes, I said, but we do because we have the power to change the minorities who do rule, and that can't be done here in Cuba. You're the minority, and you can't be changed.
He's a minority of one versus an open. That's a fascinating, fascinating insight. What else took place in that conversation with Fidel Castro that was memorable?
Well, I think almost all of it was memorable, but the sense that, look, he is a dictator, and he's done some terrible things.
And now his brother running the country, also a dictator?
Yes, and they put a lot of innocent people away. And there's no disregarding that. And they did foment revolutions in Latin America.
Mm-hmm.
Some people thought those revolutions were good. Others thought they were terrible. They certainly weren't liked by the United States. So I'm not making any excuses for Castro. But They are really afraid that the United States was going to conquer them,
mm-hmm.
come attack them. And they had, you know, plenty of reason to believe that. For Castro was well aware of all the attempts that we made on his life.
Mm-hmm.
Another meeting we had was with the Cuban chairman of the Joint Chiefs, of their Joint Chiefs of Staff, who gave a long spiel to my wife and me about how they believe we were still going to attack them, full-scale American invasion.
Still to this day.
Yeah. And when he finished, I said, I think there is no chance the United States of America is going to invade Cuba. And then I gave him the reasons why. He started to cry. He stood up.
Like weeping, like tears.
Yes. And he came around the table to hug me.
Really?
Now, you know,
that's fascinating.
I don't believe that was an act. I believe he really thought the United States was going to invade Cuba.
That's absolutely amazing. So we're speaking with Dr. Leslie Gelb, expert on foreign affairs. Let's shift a little bit to Iran. I don't get the sense that any of the Mullers are going to be hugging anyone from the United States anytime soon.
They won't. The Mullers are very dangerous guys.
Really?
Sure they are.
So who's driving the atomic desires in Iran?
I think that the Iranian people, from everything we know, from all the reporting we have going on in that country, Iranian people support a peaceful nuclear program.
Do they really need that, given their vast oil reserves?
Well, they think they do. Mm-hmm. Who are we to say they don't?
I think we could legitimately say, not only do you have vast oil reserves, you're in the middle of the desert, near the equator. If you want to set up solar farms, you probably have more energy than you could ever consume in 1,000 years. Why on earth would you need a nuclear program?
Because they think
except to build a bomb.
They think this is a cheap form of energy. They're worried about being able to sell oil in the future as energy sources change.
That's a 50-year concern.
But they are concerned about it.
Mm-hmm.
Again, everything we know from the reporting countrywide is that there is considerable support for having these nuclear peaceful programs. Not that the people are calling for Iran to have nuclear weapon. There's no evidence of that at all. None. And even the Ayatollah, who we don't like and really is a troublemaker, keeps repeating they don't want to build a bomb.
So what do we think
is going to— I don't believe them, by the way.
Oh, I don't think a lot of people believe that claim. What do we think the odds of this treaty actually getting passed? Doesn't require approval from the Senate. All they could do is stop it. Do we think that this is actually going to be put into effect? Chuck Schumer notwithstanding.
Yeah, I think that before Schumer announced his opposition, that they did a vote count in the Senate,
mm-hmm.
and they came to the conclusion that a presidential veto to bring the treaty into force would be sustained.
Mm-hmm.
So Schumer's vote was not going to
So that was a little political horse trading?
Well, I don't know if it was horse trading, but Schumer could go ahead and make his announcement, which I think wasn't based on much substance, without fearing that he was going to kill the treaty off.
And he's appealing to one of those minorities, the Jewish American lobby, that's been very vocal about this deal.
They've made it an enormous issue, and it's going to hurt Israel standing here in the United States.
Really?
Including with people who oppose the agreement. It will. Because they've gone too far in interfering in American politics.
Benjamin Netanyahu speaking in the UN,
exactly.
Speaking on the floor of the Senate. You think that boomerangs back against Israel?
Eventually it will hurt, yes.
So we talked briefly before about oil, and let me pose a different foreign affairs question. You know, the United States has been a huge importer of oil for a long time. And now, between what we've found in the Gulf and fracking, and we're rapidly approaching the day where the U.S. becomes energy independent. And I'm not talking a century or many, many decades. Sometime in the next, call it 5 to 10 years, we're going to become a net exporter of energy. When that happens, what does that do to our interests in the Middle East?
I hope it lessens our interest in the Middle East. Because I don't, as you could tell from other things I've just said, place much hope or reliance on our Gulf state allies. They've done us some great harm. And I think we've done—
When you say Gulf state allies, you mean Saudi Arabia, Israel, and who else?
No, I don't mean Israel.
Just Saudi Arabia.
Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Kuwait, United Arab Emirates, and the like. The people who have funded these jihadis all over the world. Where do you think the Taliban got their arms and money from? They got it from heaven? They didn't get it from heaven.
So with friends like these, who needs enemies?
Indeed.
So if, in the last 30 seconds we have, if people want to find your writings, where's the best place for them to see your views and your perspectives?
In two places. One is the Daily Beast.
Mm-hmm.
I've written a lot for them over the last 8 or 9 years or so. And in the National Interest magazine.
Fantastic. We've been speaking with Dr. Leslie Gelb discussing foreign policy. If you enjoy this conversation, be sure and check out the podcast extras where we let the tape roll and we continue the conversation. Check out my daily column at BloombergView.com or follow me on Twitter at Ritholtz. I'm Barry Ritholtz. You've been listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio. Welcome to the podcast extras. Dr. Gelb, or less, as you've asked me to call you, thank you so much for doing this. This is really absolutely fascinating. There's so many things I want to go over. We haven't even talked about what's happening with China and their currency. We'll get to that in a little bit. Let's go back to the Pentagon Papers, which we really just quickly touched on. Describe what that process was like creating that, what sort of hell broke loose when the Times got their hands on it, and what it meant for the Supreme Court to issue their no prior restraint decisions, if I'm remembering all those things correctly. So let's start with creating the Pentagon Papers. What was that process like?
Well, it's not like you hear about it, because McNamara at first started the project to answer 100 questions that he and a few other people had set down. About 10 of those questions were historical. Mm-hmm. And the others were about the pacification program, about the political process in Saigon, and could it work, and so forth. There were 100 questions that one of his military aides wrote out by hand.
Really?
Yeah. And we were to answer them. Then I put together a small group, and basically everyone agreed that we'd give the same kind of baloney, superficial answers to these questions if we just sat down to write them. And to get some perspective on it, we ought to look at the history of our involvement. Sent a memo into McNamara. He said, go do it. Let the chips fall where they may.
Really?
Yeah. So we started to do these monographs. And basically the monographs, which very few people have read, are sort of straight recounting of the issue. There's one on pacification that sort of tells you document by document, summarizing them, what the history of how we handled pacification was, or why we made the decision to send in the Marines in March 65 and so forth. And the only sort of analytical parts of the Pentagon Papers were the brief summary statements at the beginning of each monograph, which I took the credit or blame for in my transmission document. And I did so because most of our authors were military, and they didn't want to get stuck with having an opinion on this and that to their superiors. So I took responsibility for writing all those analytical statements, which really weren't very analytical or very presumptuous. They're put more or less straightforward.
So within that, within the research and creation of the Pentagon Papers, the question that, I mean, I was born in 61. The Vietnam War as a kid was always a background thing.
Right.
And the question that to this day I still can't answer is, so why did we really go in there? What was the point?
That's the key question, because it applies today too. Look, Ellsberg created the impression that we got in because our government lied to the American people about the stakes and what was involved and why it was important. But that's just false. It's plain wrong, including Ellsberg himself. Ellsberg himself was a big supporter of the war through a good chunk of the 60s. He joined the Marines. He went over there and he fought. The reason we got involved in Vietnam, and it's critical that we understand it, for what we get into trouble with today. The reason we got involved is we believed our way into the war. We saw Indochina as the cockpit of the war between Soviet Union, Chinese communism against the United States of America.
When you say we believed our way in.
Yes, we thought the biggest threat to the United States was from the Chinese Soviet alliance and from world communism. And just as we saw Berlin as the major focal point for this in Europe, we saw Indochina as the major focal point in Asia. And people believed we had to stop. I hardly knew anybody in the foreign policy profession who differed with it, including Dan Ellsberg, including my buddy David Halberstam.
Really?
His 1964 book, The Making of a Quagmire, ends with a chapter that is the best argument for the domino theory I've ever read.
Really?
Yeah, so we believed our way into the war.
But wait, so he argues for the domino theory, meaning that if we don't stop them here, it'll be country after country until it's at our doorstep, and yet the book is about, in 1964, that's pretty early to say, hey, Vietnam is going to be a quagmire, and for the next decade, it was.
Indeed it was, and how important it was to win. Now, David's views changed over time, David Halberstam's. As did mine. I was a supporter of the war. I didn't know anything about Vietnam, but to me it was the crunch point in the battle against communism. And it took a long time for me to evolve. It took a very long time for my foreign policy profession to evolve because we believed in it. The same thing happened with how we fight Afghanistan or how we fight Iraq. We believe our way into these wars because we make these decisions without knowing about the countries we're getting involved in.
Mm-hmm.
You know, on Vietnam, I had read one book. I wrote a good many of the memos of the Secretary of Defense to the President of the United States when I was Director of Policy Planning in the Pentagon. And I had read one book on Vietnam, Bernard Fall's The Two Vietnams. Mm-hmm. And that was more than most people there had read. We had no knowledge of the place. The same applied to Afghanistan. The same applied to Iraq. All of a sudden, we throw in the troops as if force is going to solve centuries of culture, politics, and internal problems. And it never does.
So let's, I want to come back to Iraq in a minute. Let's stay with Vietnam for a second. So if the theory is that we're containing communism and therefore we have to project power all around the world to prevent the domino theory, doesn't that say we really don't have a belief, a strong belief, in our own system of capitalism and free markets and open trade? Isn't 'cause that's how I always am astonished at the stop communism argument. Well, if our system is so vastly superior, and I think history has shown that it is, why can't we allow the system itself to support itself? Why can't the benefits of free markets stand on their own without military interventions mm-hmm. all around the world creating this very, very different sort of battle? It's an economic battle, not a military battle. Or is that the wrong way to look at this?
Well, it depends on the country. In the case of Vietnam, it was nationalism that we were fighting.
Mm-hmm.
That was the root cause of it. You know, I was very close to an Army officer who went out and commanded an air cavalry battalion in one of the main battles that was fought in the Central Highlands of Vietnam.
When you say air cavalry, I think of Army. Apocalypse Now, helicopters, ground troops, PT boats, the whole thing. Yeah.
And he was the commander of a battalion. He was a lieutenant colonel at the time. And he wrote me a note. I was working for Javits at the time. He wrote me a note saying we just had the first major battle with North Vietnamese forces in the Central Highlands of South Vietnam. And I can't tell you how proud I was of my troops, how well they fought with such skill and such courage. There was only one problem. The North Vietnamese fought better. And there are only two explanations for this. One is they were on dope, and the other is they were on nationalism. And if they were on nationalism, boy, are we going to have trouble.
They're defending their own home country.
Yeah.
And there's an advantage to that.
And Ho Chi Minh was regarded by many Vietnamese as the father of Vietnamese nationalism. You know, I don't like his communist system or anything like that, but he had the monopoly of nationalism, not only in the north, but in the south with the Viet Minh forces who were also backing him.
Mm-hmm.
And when that's what you have going for you, it's hard to deal with it. Look at Syria today. You have these fanatics fighting, and the people we trained for years in Iraq and armed with the best of armaments. As soon as the ISIS attacked them, they dropped their arms, they
ran away.
Took their uniforms off and ran away.
So let's apply the lessons of Vietnam to Iraq. First question is, same question as Vietnam. Why did we go into Iraq? Nobody really believes the weapons of mass destruction. That was...
Well, I wouldn't say that that's so. You know, I was very friendly with George Tenet, who was the director
sure.
of the CIA at the time. And I asked him outright at the time, do we have a smoking gun on the weapons of mass destruction? And he said, no, we don't have a smoking gun, but all of us very much believe that they do have these weapons of mass destruction programs.
Say, believed our way into another war? Is that
yeah,
is that what
we
we're saying?
We did believe it, because here Saddam had attacked Iran. We didn't like Iran, but they attacked him. And it was a seven-year war.
Right.
And they used chemical weapons against Iran.
They've been using chemical weapons, though, for a long, long time, haven't
well,
they?
Well, they did have a record of it. They also used chemical weapons against their own Kurdish people.
Right.
And they had just invaded Kuwait, and we had to fight to kick them out of Kuwait.
That was 91 or 93,
right,
something
under
like that?
George H.W. Bush.
Right. So we knew he was hostile. We knew he was aggressive.
Right. And there was genuine concern that he had these weapons of mass destruction. Was there proof? No. But there was enough evidence floating around in combination with his behavior over the previous 10 years plus to make people feel you had to go after him. Now, they didn't take the next step, which they must take in order to have a rational policy, is saying, then what are we going to do?
What
happens after?
How are
we going to conduct this war?
Right. Nobody doubts for a second that the United States military isn't going to steamroll over
exactly.
the National Guard. But after that, and now the current thesis that I keep hearing is ISIS is essentially the reconstituted Saddam troops and weaponry that laid low for a few
years.
We
don't even know that. We know that some of Saddam's officers are involved with them, but that these are, you know, Sunnis who escaped from Iraq and are now Syrians fighting for ISIS. I think that's exaggerated.
So this brings us back to the original question. September 11th happens in 2001.
Yes.
We go after Afghanistan, which is where these attacks come from. By the way, you mentioned our friends, the Saudis, funded a lot of the
Taliban.
Not only the Taliban, but a lot of the hijackers themselves were Saudis.
Oh, yes.
So they were very much
yes,
involved.
Indeed.
So we go into Afghanistan, and then somehow, by 2003, we tack somehow we change and shift our focus to Iraq.
Yes.
Was that a prudent either foreign policy or military response to where we were at the time?
It was dumb, and I endorsed it at the time.
So you endorsed it, but now you're saying that was a mistake.
After 3 months, and I saw...
That's the fastest reversal of everybody who supported.
It was fast, but I was for it initially. And when it was clear they didn't have the weapons of mass destruction, I opposed it. And on top of it, I saw we had no idea what we were doing.
Clearly.
There had been no plan for fighting the war.
So it seems, you know, it's funny. There's a joke about people in finance, and it's essentially says... people in finance are notorious for refusing to learn from experience in history.
Yes.
But it sounds like finance people don't really hold a candle to military people.
Nothing like and foreign policy people and making mistakes.
The
same mistakes over and again, which is why over time I developed the philosophy that guides me in thinking about foreign affairs, that you're going to make the mistakes. They're inevitable. I don't care how smart you are, because we're involved in various parts of the world where our knowledge is slight and where our power doesn't add up to our desires. And we're going to make mistakes. And the most important thing you can do is keep your mind open to the possibility that you did make a mistake so that you can see it and fix it and not cause the blunders and the suffering that we do when we persist in our mistakes.
So speaking of persisting in mistakes, let me ask you a question. Which was worse, the eras in Vietnam or the eras in Iraq?
I think Vietnam really was. You know, we lost over 50,000 men killed.
10 times what we lost in Iraq.
And people forget, but we had 550,000 troops in Vietnam. And
nearly all draftees, not a whole lot of voluntary conscripts.
Absolutely.
That's a very different war than sending 100,000 people who are volunteers to another country.
Absolutely.
And the ramifications domestically to the Vietnam War looks like it was very, very significant. Iraq has created some pushback, but nothing like what we saw in the 1960s.
I think that's right. 60s really was a revolution inside the United States. And frankly, I think it caused a lot of people, good people, to stay away from politics. I don't think the quality of people who run for office today, hold office today, are as good as they were when I was a young man in Washington.
You know, it's funny. Let's shift gears and talk about politics a little bit. So I grew up in Nassau County, out in Long Island, very Republican area. And Jacob Javits was my senator. And whenever I try and describe, and people on the left and right, none of my friends believe me, but it's absolutely true, I describe myself as a Jacob Javits Republican. All right? And four quick bullet points. Low taxes, balanced budgets, no overseas adventures, and keep the government out of people's bedrooms. That's pretty fair statement, those four.
No, because he actually was pretty much of a hawk on foreign policy. He was a big supporter of the Vietnam War until late in the game.
Well, when I learned who he was, he had reversed himself. Right. And following the Vietnam War, I recall him saying things like, look, if we're going to project power, if we're going to go to war overseas, it can't be for some abstract theory. It has to be to protect the United States.
Yes.
And not. So I was too young to know him when he was a hawk. I knew him as no overseas misadventures.
Yeah, he became the author of the law that sort of gave Congress a chance to say no to military involvement after 30 days.
That's how I know him, as opposed to maybe how he began when I was a much right. younger child. But the funny thing about that corner of politics, that on the spectrum, a fiscally conservative, socially progressive, call it center-right political position, you can't find that amongst the Republicans anymore. The whole spectrum has shifted so much that what was once a center-right position now seems like it's a left-wing position.
Yes.
So what does that say? How much does that traces to the reaction, the pushback to Vietnam socially, and just the parties becoming more extreme? And from my perspective, formerly thinking I'm center-right and suddenly finding myself center-left, to me, it looks like the right wing has gotten, the left wing has gotten some extreme elements, but the right wing looks like it's really tacked to an extreme political position, some of which is the Reagan coalition starting to fracture and people really tacking to that far right base to get, we see it in the
yes.
primary part. By the way, that's the most you're going to hear me say about anything this whole interview, but I'm really curious as to your view on how this political spectrum in the United States has shifted.
Yeah, we always had nuts on the left and the right.
Okay.
When I worked for Javits, they were there, to be sure.
But they were kind of marginalized.
Here's the difference. Not that they were marginalized. It's that they were what I would call 25 or so national interest senators of both parties.
Mm-hmm.
Who, if an issue were really important, would put politics aside
right.
and try to get something done. So if it was critical and you needed a law passed that in order to solve a problem, they would get together and do it.
So what happened to that sort of?
It disappeared. See, they all left.
You know, so it's party first,
like
country
Bill
second.
Bill Bradley, Sam Nunn, et cetera,
sure.
et cetera.
Centrist,
Scott,
moderate,
Chuck
rational
Percy,
guys.
They all left the place because they got totally frustrated with American politics. And it began at the time of the Vietnam War. The people who unfortunately didn't get frustrated were the extremists, particularly on the right. They decided that this was their great opportunity to go in and control politics.
And they've been fairly successful.
Yeah, including in defeating moderate conservatives.
Which is astonishing to think that that battle between the right and the far right is being won by the far right. That's not usually, it's always been the center holds and that's where right. The power lays. But that seems to be changing.
They won it hands down except for presidential nominees, Reagan being the exception people bring up. But in fact, Reagan was not a crazy right-wing president at all. He was a conservative president.
Not a nut by any means.
The
argument is that Reagan couldn't get nominated today.
I don't think he could.
That's an astonishing.
I don't think he could.
That's an astonishing.
He raised taxes, remember?
Repeatedly.
Yes.
Well, he had a huge tax cut. He took that top rate way down. He got rid of all those crazy, you know, tax shelters and real estate shelters and all those things, which is why some guy named Donald Trump was not happy with him way back when. But slowly raised taxes to balance the budget. You know, today you have the pledge. You have Grover Norquist. So that center-right, moderate, or even just ordinary conservative, they don't seem to really be finding a voice in politics today.
That's true. Interestingly, they're divided on foreign policy, national security, where you have the Tea Party guys like the Pauls,
mm-hmm.
who tend to be a touch isolationist.
Very much
get
so.
Involved in wars.
In fact, ISIS caused Rand Paul to back off of that.
Yes.
But they're very much isolationists, and I respect the, hey, we're spending way too much on the military argument from Ron Paul. Rand Paul seems to have less of a commitment to that than his father did.
Less because he's running for president, mm-hmm. And he thinks he's got to modify it for that reason.
His dad ran for president and never changed anything.
His dad was more of a true believer.
Mm-hmm. So let's
son is more of a politician,
to say the least. So let's come back to the Middle East policy. We talked about Iraq. What's going to happen with our relations going forward with Israel? Are they going to be chastened by their overreach? Are they going to have a possible change of leadership? What happens?
There's no chance of a change in leadership. Netanyahu's position inside Israel
solid.
Is very strong.
Yes.
And there is overwhelming opposition within Israel mm-hmm. to this agreement with Iran. And none of that is going to change. Obama has tried to compensate by offering Israel some arms, some mm-hmm. high-tech arms that he had previously denied them. But that's not going to change their mind about any of this. And we're going to go through a few years of just very nasty talk from Israeli leadership about Democrats because of their support for this. Hillary is trying to avoid it by, as usual, not taking a position, strong position on it. But you'll get a lot of anti-democratic feeling from Israelis. As far as American Jews are concerned, the polls show 60-70% are in favor of the treaty with Iran. And about 20-25% are opposed to it.
The hardliners are very much against it. So if you have 60-70% of U.S. Jews disagreeing with Israelis supporting President Obama, what does that mean for the odds of this policy, this treaty actually becoming the law of the land?
Well, I think it will. At least the people who do the vote counting say that a presidential veto will be sustained in the Senate.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know about the House, but in the Senate.
That's really the only place that matters.
Yes,
if you can't override into both houses, that's it. This becomes
law.
Right. Is there any chance down the road that there's a detente between Israel and Iran? Is that something that's possible?
Not for a long time to come. Look, I've spent a good deal of my life working on arms control, even though I didn't believe arms control was arms control. I think arms control was a way of managing relations with an adversary.
Right.
And if you look at the history of all the arms control treaties we reached, they didn't solve the problems. They minimized the problems to varying degrees. They lessened the problem, or they put the most serious problems off into the future where there was a better chance of managing them. We've kind of forgotten that arms control agreements are not agreements of surrender by one party to another.
Mm-hmm.
You're trying to bargain with another state that has its own interests and is not going to give certain things up. And you make agreements to lessen the threat, which this agreement absolutely does. Mm-hmm. Even the critics say the main point is, well, in 10 to 15 years, they can decide they don't want to abide by this anymore.
It's 15 years from now.
That's a long time.
Right.
For
as opposed to Tuesday.
Exactly. And that's the central point to keep making to people. But it's hard to get through when the hysteria has reached the proportions it has.
There certainly are histrionics coming out. And it's coming up on a presidential election year, which just amplifies that
Absolutely.
Even more. All right, so let's shift gears, and I'm going to take you to a different part of the world. Let's talk about Russia and the Ukraine. So you had said previously that they had set up Ukrainian-speaking Russians and special forces within Ukraine and were fomenting civil dissent.
Yeah, they caused the problem. There's no question
about it. The Russians.
Yes.
What's their end game? What does Putin want? He got Crimea. What does he want from Ukraine?
Yeah, I think what he wants is to establish Russia again as a major power and wants to be treated as a major power.
Is Putin not treated as a major power?
I think that there's a lot to show from a Russian point of view that we diminish them. And we diminish them in all sorts of ways.
Certainly economically.
Economically, including in Ukraine, where the Europeans made a proposal, in effect, to incorporate Ukraine into the European economy and push Russia aside. It's intolerable
given
Russian history and to somebody like Putin.
Right.
The central thing about Russians and foreign policy for hundreds of years is they like to flex their muscles. They like to be the great power. They like to be treated like the boss. And they lost the Cold War. The country was diminished in size and in power.
And stature, for sure.
In all these respects. And then, you know, here we do this with Ukraine. We bring the Baltic states into NATO. These are states that used to be part of the Soviet Union. And now they're under NATO. It looked like we were going to bring Georgia and Ukraine into NATO as well. And I think Putin has been fighting against all of this. Now, I wouldn't give him the right. These countries don't belong to him.
Sure.
But as a great power, he has a right to a say in those countries and what happens there. Just as we would have a right to what happens in our hemisphere. People have forgotten about the Monroe Doctrine.
Sure.
Which is a pretty blatant assertion of U.S. Authority and rights in the hemisphere. What if China would open up military bases in Mexico? What do you think we would do about that?
We would not
be
happy.
Go insane.
Right.
So you have to understand it from Putin's point of view. The second thing you have to understand is that on their western borders, Russia has military superiority over the United States and the West.
Sure.
See, people don't know that, though.
I've read about World War II. The Germans, if Hitler didn't attack Russia, the outcome could have been very different.
Oh, there's no question about it. But here, today, people think, you know, Russia is on its knees. On its borders, western borders.
Thousands of
with
tanks.
With Ukraine, yes, aircraft, air defenses, whatnot. A couple of months ago, the Supreme Allied Commander for NATO, General Breedlove, American general.
Oh, sure.
He was on Christiane Amanpour.
On CNN.
On CNN, and he was saying this to her.
that they have a massive military might
military superiority
on the western border.
And they can trump us militarily, whatever we do. We want to put in more aid to Ukraine. They can put in even more to their supporters in eastern Ukraine. You want to start shooting bullets, they can shoot more bullets right on their borders. Beyond their borders, we have the superiority.
Right.
But on their borders, they've got it. And Christiane responded when he was finished, wow.
No idea.
She said, no idea. She said, wow.
If you know World War II history, and I don't call myself a military history buff, but I read Keegan's book, and I read a lot of the big fascinating stories about what took place. Not too long ago, I was in St. Petersburg. You see some of the old memorials and what took place there. Russia always has had a massive European-looking military force.
They have. Let me tell you the end of that conversation now.
Mm-hmm.
She says, wow. And then she says, but then what would you do about it? He said, well, of course, we got to keep up our military strength. But we need diplomacy.
This is a general saying this to...
Yes, the general. And I've had loads of conversations with senior NATO generals. They all say the same thing. You need diplomacy. You need to work out a kind of relationship with the Russians where they are treated like a major power. You don't give them the Baltic states or Ukraine, but you take their interest into account. Look, how do you judge whether Russia matters? Russia is no longer a global superpower, but they are a great power. And how do you measure that? You measure it in terms of whether Russia can help or hurt us in various parts of the world. And they can. Who can help us more than any other country in dealing with what's happening in Syria and Iraq? It's Russia.
Mm-hmm.
Fighting terrorism. Russia has one of the best anti-terrorist operations in the world, including
really?
Intelligence. Absolutely.
Now that I'm going to say wow about.
In terms of nuclear proliferation, Russia is a major partner of ours. Look, they just did it with Iran.
They, by the way, fascinating, the Russian interest in Iran and how much they were really a key actor in helping that treaty move forward.
They were central to it. And in the case of the states on their western borders, they can hurt us unless you have some diplomacy that takes their interest into account, doesn't give them control of these countries, but gives them a say so that they're treated like a major power, like we would expect to be treated on our borders.
So given, you know, if it would have been a president like George Bush, who wasn't a big believer in diplomatic efforts, I would say, well, of course we're not having any luck with Russia. But the present administration, Iran, Cuba, elsewhere, although we seem to not be very successful with China on certain diplomatic efforts, why isn't this administration recognizing what generals like Breedlove says and paying? Look, no one expects the United States to pay homage to Putin, but it sounds like he's looking for some respect, some recognition, and some input into the decision-making process. Given how helpful he was in Iran, why aren't we having a better engagement and better relationship with Russia?
Good question. There are a lot of people inside even this administration who think they can knock Russia to the floor.
Well, what's the upside of that? Why?
You know, I think they're just dead wrong, but they're people inside and people they consult on the outside who have this point of view. And not all generals agree with Breedlove. The new chairman of the Joint Chiefs, and testifying before the Senate a few weeks ago, said Russia is the biggest threat, security threat to the United States. So you have people who say these things, and then they don't say what they're going to do about it.
Right.
Practically.
You know, the... In St. Petersburg, there's a memorial to the civilians. During World War II, the Germans encircled the city, which is really very much on the western border. It's long before they went deep into the Russian winter further east. And they tried to starve the city out. And I'm trying to remember, some ungodly number of civilians died in St. Petersburg. Just insane, insane numbers. And the Russians, these are really tough people. they didn't, it went a year or two. They didn't surrender. They didn't give up. They kept the Germans at bay. Not a lot of cities could have survived what the Germans put St. Petersburg through.
Absolutely.
Anyone who thinks that you're going to just shove the Russians over and they're going to topple, you just have to read military history. Yeah. That ain't going to happen. Do you need to go back to Napoleon? That's not going to happen.
Yeah, but you see, it's not just Russia. We thought we would do it with Cuba. We thought we could do it with Iran, and economic sanctions, political pressure, even military pressure did not bring these countries to their knees. And what do people want? Do they want to go to war with Iran? What do they think the consequences of that would be? Did we want to invade Cuba? Only some nuts wanted to invade Cuba.
So I only have you for a couple of more minutes. Let me go to some of my favorite few short questions that I ask all my guests, and then we'll get you out of here on time.
Okay.
So aside from Senator Javits, who were some of your early mentors?
Well, I would say Clark Clifford, who replaced McNamara, Secretary of Defense, was a major influence in my life, because he really brought home to me the importance of thinking through strategy before you made your first moves on any area of importance. And if it took 2 weeks to do it or whatever, you take that time to do it before you start moving. Otherwise, you trap yourself.
Sounds like common sense, but
it's pure common sense, but it isn't done. You can see it time and again in decisions made by presidents after presidents.
So aside from Clifford, let's talk a little more philosophy. What thinkers influenced your approach to either foreign policy or economics?
Yeah, I would say the realist school. Mm-hmm. Henry Kissinger was my PhD advisor at Harvard.
Oh, really?
And I was his teaching fellow in his courses there.
He's a realist, if nothing else.
He's a realist. And I think that's basically the framework I've adopted in dealing with the world. I believe in power. I don't think you get things done through what we like to call soft power, that we persuade people we understand their interests better than they do. We think our values are going to get them to restrain themselves. It just doesn't happen.
Right.
It doesn't happen. What happens is power, where you get people to do things or not to do things because you change their calculus about their interests, what they're going to gain, what they're going to lose. And if you can't affect that calculus, you're not going to be able to achieve what you want.
Pure carrot and stick.
It's pretty much that, yes.
So we talked about the shifts in politics. What major shifts have you seen take place in diplomacy, and are these a good thing or a bad thing?
Yeah, I don't think we've adjusted to the world of the 21st century.
Us in the United States, our foreign policy approach.
Mostly us.
Really?
Yeah, because we have more responsibility than anyone else. If there's any problem anywhere in the world, people immediately turn to the United States. And unfortunately, too often, we try to go respond to it without knowing what to do and without thinking through
Clifford's
strategy.
Clifford's approach, actually.
Absolutely.
Give it real thought. What are some of your favorite books that have influenced either your thinking or changed your mind about different aspects of foreign policy?
I think mainly history books. I try to immerse myself in history, mainly to see how things went wrong and on those few occasions how they went right, to give myself more of a finger feel and an intellectual appreciation of the difficulties of dealing with problems that you can't control, where you have to use your power, and the power can't make things in and of itself come out the way you want.
Let me shift up my second to last question. I always ask people what advice they'd give to a millennial or someone graduating college about their career, but let me ask you it slightly differently. Someone comes to you just graduating college and says, I'm interested in a career in the State Department or foreign affairs or diplomacy. What sort of advice would you give them?
I would say first demonstrate to your boss that you know how to get things done, which means you think through a strategy.
I'm sensing a theme here.
You think through a strategy and you figure out how to deal with people well enough to move the pieces along so that in whatever it takes, a week or 3 months, your boss sees you've accomplished it. And if he sees that, you're going to get ahead.
Last question. What do you know today about foreign affairs, diplomacy, military power, economic might that you wish you knew when you began 50 years ago?
I think that I should have had a better appreciation of what our power could accomplish in different places at different times and what it could not accomplish.
Limitations on the projection of power.
And what you could do, too. What you could do and what you couldn't do.
Fantastic. Both. Dr. Gelb, thank you so much for being so generous with your time. There's so many things we didn't get to, but I know you have other places to go today. We've been speaking with Dr. Leslie Gelb on the impact of the economy and projections of power. If you enjoyed this conversation, look an inch higher or lower on Apple iTunes and you'll see the other 50 or so shows we've done. Be sure and check out my daily column on BloombergView.com. Follow me on Twitter at Ritholtz. I want to thank Mike Batnick, my head of research, for helping us out. Charlie Vollmer is our producer and our engineer. Today is Matt Ryan. I'm Barry Ritholtz. You're listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio.